Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
The Word is proud media partner of Latitude Festival.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, it's 11 o'clock in the morning in the Word Lounge at Latitude Festival. You can probably hear some of the sounds of merriment starting up. A relatively blue sky. On my right, David Hepworth.
Hello.
Speak, David. Hello. Know your voice. And on our left, very excitedly, Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Wonderful.
It's lovely to be back.
Yeah, large happens,
thank
Jeff
you.
Lloyd.
And these are salubrious surroundings compared to where we were last year. We were like in a site manager's office in a porter cabin.
We were actually in a porter cabin.
Yeah.
Although our digital editor is sleeping in the porter cabin here.
Is that right?
And I have to say, it was the envy of all on Saturday night.
We ought to tell the story, actually, of Fraser's injury over the Latitude weekend, didn't we? Because I arrived here on Friday, and he was fine. He was bouncing around. And then 2 hours later, he was pretty much crumpled up in a corner because he'd torn a muscle, hadn't you, Fraser? Fraser can't take part because he's over there, but he's waving.
I went to the medical tent and I said, look, our man is injured. We can't get him up here. Is there any way I can get some advice? What to look? I said, oh, we'll come down. I said, well, you can't see the Rock Festival. You must be surely rushed off your feet. I said, all we've had so far, one bee sting. So that was fantastic.
That's
so
very Latitude.
That reflects
yeah,
very
no
well.
No mosh pit injuries.
No, there's just the occasional fairy with a broken wing.
Yeah,
I think
it's
a bit of repairing.
So they're looking forward to the download festival.
Somebody with a paper cut in the literary tent.
That's exactly it.
Absolutely. And so Fraser was, a pleasant diversion for him. And so they took him and bandaged him up, didn't they? Then gave him a crutch. So for one day he had a crutch.
Filled him full of codeine.
And then he threw away
like
the crutch.
Had a lopsided smile.
Because he's a New Zealander and they're dead hard.
Yeah.
And now he's absolutely fine.
He threw away his crutch and he rose again and walked.
Yeah. There you go.
I used to work with a guy in Manchester who was in a band. Do you remember the Salford Jets? Does that ring
yes,
any bells?
Yeah, it rings a bell.
So there was sort of like a pub rock band. John Bramwell's over there. You'll remember them. Mike Sweeney's band. Yeah. And they had one hit, which was called "Who You Looking At?", which was as aggressive as it sounds. Anyway, the singer Mike Sweeney.
B side was "What You Want."
Yeah, yeah.
You and Who's Army.
Yeah. So he then went on to become a local radio personality in Manchester, and he was brilliant in so many ways because he had this gruff Salford accent and. He had a face only a mother could love, and he was nothing like your stereotype of radio DJs, which, of course, all commercial radio was like back then, to the extent that he used to take a rifle into contract negotiations with him. He'd go in
that
and he'd,
is
say,
aggressive.
He'd say to the MD, I'm just going shooting afterwards, I hope you don't mind me leaving that there. Anyway,
don't
about this pay
loaded.
Rise. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, this does relate to Fraser in an odd way. He is also a very, very thrifty man, and to the extent that they had a vending machine for drinks where I think a cup of coffee was 5p, and he would frequently come along and go, Lloydie, I've only got a 50p piece and I don't want to break into it. Could you lend us 5p? It's very tight. So he took his kids to Disneyland, and one of them fell over and grazed their knee. And they were fine, it wasn't a serious injury at all. However, he just insisted in his pugnacious way that they gave him a wheelchair for this kid. Nothing at all to do with the fact that the kid had hurt itself, but everything to do with the fact that, because when you have a wheelchair at straight to the front of the queue,
fast
rides,
right.
yeah. And I wonder if that's applicable to gigs as well.
It could be. Well, Fraser could, of course, be just wheeled out to the very front of Swades.
Yes.
With his foot up. If you were actually in full traction, you'd probably be allowed to get on stage and sing back.
So you've been broadcasting from here the whole weekend.
Yes, I have. And I wanted to take umbrage at something you said recently, David, which was on Twitter. You said that there is never any good backstage gossip radio station, television station, no. Newspaper coverage. You said there is never any worthwhile gossip.
Before you prove me completely wrong, which I'm sure you will, this was based on the fact that every year the BBC's coverage of Glastonbury or whatever, they always say, and we'll be there with all the backstage gossip. They all say at the Brits, we'll be there with all the backstage gossip. And I think, there never is any backstage gossip.
Well, listen to this.
This is
some gossip
Settle
which
down.
Involves two pieces of wood. One, I would say, is probably 6 feet by 3 feet, the other one slightly larger. So yesterday, and it's... People wonder what it's like backstage at festivals, and it's...
Describe it.
Okay, so if you
take
imagine...
us into that magic world, Jack.
Imagine if society is broken down. And then from the spare bits that are lying around, people construct it. It's like a refugee camp.
If society has broken down, which is the best bit of society to be in? The bit out here or the bit backstage?
Out here, undoubtedly. Oh, right. I think it does vary from festival to festival, but at Latitude... It's so lovely out here, no thought is really given to back there. So anyway, as we know, there's been a certain amount of rain over recent days. And
barely noticed.
Of course, what follows is a certain amount of mud. And where we are, we've got a VW camper van to conduct the interviews in, and then two porta cabins for people, you know, uploading things to the internet or sheltering from the elements or whatever they're doing. And... the mud was so bad back there, they took two measures. Firstly, they piled a load of wood chip into the mud, which has created the most unholy smell to the extent I've been asking interview guests to speculate on what kind of bowel movement that is, what creature would make that kind of smell, because it's vile, it's beyond cattle. It's and then the other thing, that certain makeshift bridges have been made out of these pieces of wood. There's some wood lying around, so we made a makeshift bridge to our porter cabin so people being interviewed could step over it. A couple of the tour bus drivers have done the same thing. So anyway, about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, I go out to make a phone call, and there's this massive row going on. There's some kind of stagehand guy yelling in the face of the lady who's running our porter cabin. And from what I can glean, she's taking this wood from somewhere, and it wasn't her wood to help herself to. And
he is furious.
He is furious about this wood. He then spots that the nearest tour bus to us has done the same thing. So he goes over and starts berating in a much less gentlemanly fashion the tour driver of this bus. And he's like screaming at this guy, saying this wood costs money, and it's good. Anyway. The bus turns out to be C6 Steve's bus. Oh. He hears the commotion. He's not happy. He comes out and starts...
Now getting involved.
C6 gets involved. He comes out. He's got
shotgun?
He's got his lumberjack shirt on.
Oh, that's a good
start. He squares up to this guy.
Has he got any tattoos?
He has a few tattoos. And he takes off his shirt to reveal the tattoos.
Give him the
squares
wood.
Up to
Give
the guy. The throws a punch.
No.
And the guy went away. With his tail between his legs.
Fell over?
To be honest, I didn't see the punch thrown. The story...
I love the idea. It sounds like I've been back to the 70s.
Yeah,
Led Zeppelin.
At its mildest form, Steve, like... made a fist. He made a fist.
Yep.
His most extreme version of the story that I've heard, the man was hospitalised.
Yeah,
I'm not sure where the truth lies, but I imagine it's in between.
By the time Mark Ellen is telling somebody else the story in 10 minutes, he'll be dead.
Yeah.
No doubt about it at all.
Yeah. Well, a question from the floor.
Can we change the room?
Brett Anderson.
Did you pick that up?
The suggestion was that the rumour needs to be changed, that it's Brett Anderson killing a man.
Yeah.
I imagine
then he might get in the camper van.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, I think only some form of martial art. You look at Brett Anderson, you don't think he's capable of throwing a punch, but maybe he knows some kind of Vulcan death sting or something.
Yes,
black belt.
Yeah.
You never know. Yeah.
So what have you been doing back there? Interviewing a train of people?
High-level celebrities, as we're now calling them, in the backstage gossip argot that we're now in.
Yeah, my favourite...
Who have you had in the back of your camper van? Sorry, it came out all wrong. Can I just...
Hey, here's a good one. You know when pre-Led Zeppelin, Robert Plant's roadie used to be Noddy Holder's dad? Did you know this?
That's very good. Ladies and gentlemen,
pre-Led Zeppelin, Robert Plant's roadie was Noddy Holder's dad. Noddy Holder's dad had a window cleaning round.
That's also good.
And Robert Plant used to take girls in the back of the window cleaning van with all the chamois leathers and buckets of water.
Not unwillingly, I would imagine.
No, I'm sure not. No, who can resist the chamois leather? there's none of that chamois or otherwise going on in our van. It's. I mean, I was going to describe it as professional, but that would be stretching it. My favourite so far has been Paloma Faith, who, because she was preserving her voice to perform on the main stage, she decided she wasn't going to speak. She decided she wasn't going to speak during the interview. So she turned up with a notebook.
Oh, this is
for radio. She turns up with a notebook, and she. writes down her answers, and I have to read them out at the speed at which she's writing them.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
I think you showed the massive forbearance.
About 20 minutes. It's slow going. She's not a quick writer. She doesn't know shorthand.
I'm glad you saw the funny side of that. You didn't...
Well, had it been anybody else, it might have been tiresome, but she's funny. I know her a little bit. She's been on a few times. She has got a sense of humour, Paloma.
We ought to add that, actually. I was talking to Stuart McConey here last night. Stuart, who's here this afternoon, taking part in a discussion about Britpop. And we're talking about difficult interviewees. We thought at some stage we ought to do a podcast just about the difficulty of interviewing people.
Yes.
And that Paloma Faith ought to go in there. Yeah. Because what Stuart told me was that he was rung up by somebody representing Buzz Aldrin, who was one of the three men in the first moon landing. And the PR said,
he was the second man on the moon.
He was the second man on the moon.
He always says how disappointed he is where he is.
Absolutely.
The rest of the second man on the moon.
Well, not as bad as Michael Collins, who went all the way and didn't go on the moon.
Didn't get anywhere near the moon.
Didn't get out of the bus.
That's laziness.
Yes. But anyway, Buzz Aldrin's PR said he'll talk about anything, but he doesn't want to talk about the moon.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You think, where can I go with that?
So on News International this morning, we have Buzz Aldrin.
I had a friend who was a radio producer at LBC, the speech station in London, and they booked Patti Parfitt for an interview, who is, I don't know if she's ex-wife, but at the time she was Rick Parfitt of Status Quo's wife. And just as the interview is about to start, before the microphone goes live, she goes, I'll talk about anything, but I don't want to talk about Rick or Status Quo.
Super.
Yeah.
Absolutely super.
Yeah.
Terrible.
So what, festival experiences?
Yes.
I mean, we've asked everyone who's been on the podcast for first festival experience.
What was
your first festival?
Or first one you were aware of.
Or aware of, yeah.
My first one was, do you remember the Phoenix Festival, which was just outside Stratford-upon-Avon?
Oh, well, sort of an old airdrome or something. Tarmac.
It was, exactly. And I went there covering it for my first radio station. So my first, first festival experience wasn't as a punter. It was as a young, wet-behind-the-ears boy with a tape recorder and a microphone. And I didn't know the correct procedure. I didn't know that you're supposed to ring people in advance and book these interviews, so I was just sort of wandering around.
Blundering up to Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, and it's my pleasure to say Kirsty MacColl told me to piss off.
Really?
Yeah. And,
did you get that on tape?
I did, yeah. So she'd just come off stage, and I was wandering around, just looking for people
straight
to interview. And she was sitting outside her dressing room with her feet in a bowl of water, which I'd never seen anybody do apart from my dad after a day on his post round.
So it was lovely.
Exactly. But she was sat there, trousers rolled up. A bowl of hot water, and I went over and said, Kirsty, would you mind having a quick word for KFM radio in Stockport? And it was just piss off. Nothing more. Nothing
Thank
less.
You, Kirsty.
Thank you very much, Kirsty MacColl.
So she was normally immensely pleasant, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Couldn't have been nicer. That reminds me of your story about you going backstage at a gig as a junior hack on the Record Mirror trying to get a quote.
Well, getting duffed up?
Yeah, go on.
Oh, do you want that?
Well, you were physically abused.
I can say this, actually.
You did a similar thing to what Jeff did.
Very similar. My first ever experience as a rock journalist was when I was working for the Record Mirror. I think I was about 21 or 22, and I'd been plaguing them with a copy of unsolicited prose and stuff. And eventually, they said, actually, we've got a gig for you. Actually, we've got Elvis Costello, which was the hottest ticket in town.
Yeah.
He's no trouble.
Elvis Costello. I said, why on earth are they choosing me? This is absolutely incredible. No trouble. So I get there and said you're on the guest list. On the guest list. I don't even have to pay to write. This is amazing.
You probably thought you were going to get dinner as well.
This is so exciting. I get there, of course, I'm not on the guest list. I can't get in. I thought my entire career is now on the ballot. If I don't get into this concert, it's going to be very difficult. And eventually I meet a guy in the queue. He turns out to be Elvis Costello's brother-in-law, who's 17, who says, oh, I'll go and get Elvis. It's no problem. So he brings Elvis out. I was really excited. I'm taken to the top of the queue without a wheelchair, in there, watch the concert. So I thought, after the concert, what you do if you're a reporter, you have a notebook not unlike this one, actually, spiral-bound. I went into the dressing room and said, hello, just Mark Ellen, Record Mirror. Well, I just get a couple of... Now, you're Steve Naive, isn't it, keyboard player? Is that I-E or E-I, Steve? Mr. Naive, sir? And eventually their manager came over, and I, to be fair, it was 1977, and I had very, very long hair. I looked like a very tall, very fat-faced, enormously unattractive girl in cowboy boots with a velvet jacket and very long hair. And he said, where are you from? I said, Record Mirror. He said, right, come here, mate. And he got hold of me, and I can say this because it's true.
No joke.
And he picked me up so that my feet were down. The guy called Jake Riviera.
Oh, yeah.
He can be fearsome.
Terrifying man. Yeah. Picked me up in front of Elvis, the Attractions, several members of Ian Dury's Blockhead, and one or two members of The Rumour, and bash me against the wall repeatedly with the words, "We hate the record mirror and we hate fucking hippies in velvet jackets." And he said, "Get your hair cut," and just threw me down the stairs. This is absolutely true.
Wow.
So I sort of dusted myself. "Thanks very much." So, you know, it's like your Kirsty MacColl thing. Yeah. Say, fuck off. Is it? Yeah, 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 yeah. Thanks so much. It's great. I walked home and I took off my velvet jacket and I put it in a little dustbin. Attached to it was December, and I walked all the way home, just 6 miles, in a state of complete confusion.
This is heartbreaking.
I blamed the velvet jacket. The next day, I had a yard of my hair cut off, and it's been quite a success ever since. I'd like to think so. Very I've been good. There too. Yeah,
it's such an odd moment that when you go to interview somebody and you're told you're on the guest list and you kept waiting. I remember once, again, it would have been about the same time, be told, "Look, we've got you an interview with the Wonder Stuff," who were, you know, they were front page of the Melody Maker and Sounds at the time.
Size of a cow.
Very excited. Yes. Very excited. The Manchester Apollo, queuing up for ages. Eventually I managed to convince the tour manager to let me in. I'm ushered into a dressing room. It's the drummer. It's just that's something you must always check beforehand.
Well, isn't there a famous story about somebody interviewing Tin Machine and going to Germany? You remember that one, and going and saying, which one is Mr. Bowie? That's right. So that went down extremely badly. I think one of the Sells brothers always pretended to be Bowie for the whole interview. Yeah. Awful.
Jeff, change the subject. Records. We had Robin Innes here yesterday.
Yes.
And he told us, well, he started to tell us a sad story about you losing a load of records.
This was. Now,
which will always elicit sympathy in the word podcast.
Yeah, I will. It was heartbreaking, actually. I'll preface this story by saying I haven't had a drink for 10 years. In the 10 years prior to that, I was you couldn't have breathalysed me at any stage and got
a bit disappointed.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd been DJing at some charity gig in Manchester, and they said, "Look, you come along and DJ, but we'll give you free drink." And at the time, you know, I was young and daft, and long story short, they were bringing me pint pots, which were roughly two-thirds vodka, one-third orange, and I was drinking them, and I just got in this hideous state. And then at the end of the evening, which I don't remember very clearly at all, I hailed a taxi, but it wasn't a real taxi. It was just a man in a Datsun who was, you know, taking his chances, as they do. Anyway, I wake up the next morning. I say I wake up. My mum wakes me up the next morning. I'm living in a flat in Manchester, but my mum still takes the train 20 minutes from Macclesfield once a week to come and do my ironing for
really?
Me.
Really? Perfect. Yeah. She actually...
Excellent. Which, actually, on that subject...
Good parents.
Yeah. You're a saint.
Yeah, when I moved to London at first, I used to go back to Manchester every weekend.
I thought you were saying she used to come to London.
I used to move to London. I used to come back to Manchester every weekend. And as I say, my parents lived in Macclesfield. So she used to wait on the platform at Macclesfield Station, and I would have with me a bin bag full of my laundry. I'd pass it out of the window to her, and then on the Sunday when I was on my way back, she would be there with it all pressed.
All oh, that's
yeah.
Isn't that like the old mailbags?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
An arm goes
exactly,
out.
Yeah,
Macclesfield Station, and already you're getting fucked off. Excellent.
So she didn't even get a peck on the cheek or anything.
No, it was just an exchange of laundry.
Dear.
And occasionally she would come to London, take my laundry back up north, and post it to me at the radio station. So I get this huge delivery of a box of pressed laundry. So anyway, she
recorded delivery.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, she turned up to come and help me out with my and I feel very bad about this now, but at the time I justified it by thinking, well, it's her way of keeping her hand in at parenting. You know, it's difficult to let your kids go in their early 20s.
You're doing it for her.
That was how I justified it to myself.
You're a saint.
Yeah, exactly. So anyways,
the records.
Yeah. So I got up and I was looking for where I'd put my records, and I couldn't find them anywhere. And as I started putting two and two together, I'd got in this taxi, which wasn't really a taxi. I mean, it was probably a 2-minute journey back to my flat in central Manchester, but by that stage, I'd probably forgotten that I had records with me in the first place. So I got out of this ostensibly taxi and left the records in there.
So how many?
So it would have been a box of about 250 LPs, a case of about 500 singles. And then the thing that breaks my heart is my best friend Chris, for my 21st birthday, he got, you know, the little... As a kid, you would always have those small 7-inch boxes.
You
cover them in stickers or whatever. It was one of those, and for my 21st birthday, he had filled it with our favourite records. So it's like a real compilation tape, and there was like... I remember there was... a copy of Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane with the wavy, you know, the wavy record cover in there. There was loads of stuff that we'd just like sort of grown up living together.
Give us two or three of those favourite records.
This Is the Day was in there, which I remember hearing. And, you know, we used to go to this club in Manchester called the Brick House, and they played that for us on our 21st birthday. There was loads of stuff in there. I think, like, They Don't Know Kirsty MacColl was in there. You know, some...
Piss Off written.
Yeah.
Fuck you and never buy my records again.
It just went missing, so I went on the radio next day, and, you know, with it being local radio in Manchester, everybody gets on board, and even the local... The councillor for fun, who John Bramwell over there will know, Pat Carney, who's this sort of... He's like this legendary figure on the
councillor for...
Councillor for fun. I'm not sure that's his official title, but, you know, Manchester's council is notoriously at odds with the rest of the country. Right. It's been described as a loony lefty council. Right. And
Councillor for fun.
Yeah.
Which, you have this horrible image of a sort of Ronald McDonald character with his, shoes like bananas and...
Tony Wilson gave him the name, and it kind of stuck. And I think it's unfair to describe Manchester as a loony lefty council, even though we were twinned with Leningrad in the 80s.
So you appealed for...
It became this thing. It was in the Manchester Evening News, but the records never turned up. And, there isn't a week that goes by where I don't think about those records, especially that little box of 7-inch singles.
Can I ask you a question?
That's heartbreaking.
Did you shed a tear?
I did. I wept.
Did you go quietly in your room and cry over a load of records? You see, I think I'm... I'm capable of
that. Yeah, very capable of that, yeah.
But presumably you replace them, but even replacing them, they're not the same.
So we're talking about vinyl mainly here. And sense of ownership.
That's the line at which I, stopped owning vinyl, really. That wasn't my whole collection, obviously. I've still got a few boxes of stuff in my mum and dad's attic. I take it Robin told you the story about the flood and his records.
I've heard that story. Tell that story again, because that's another absolute...
Robin Ince is... he does a very good John Peel impersonation, both in terms of the voice and in terms of...
We did a Peel off on the podcast.
Did you really?
I thought I had a strong chance. I just gave up.
I doubt
his
it.
John Peel is unbelievable.
But also, like, his record collection, he would listen avidly to Peel, and Robin had a very extensive record collection, very Peel-esque. And he had a thing where he'd recently moved into a house, and he'd gone up to Edinburgh for the summer or something like that, and came back, and there'd been some kind of leak, and not only had these records got wet, but they got covered in sewage, and beyond.
You've got to really love them to want to claim them back.
And that was that.
Even if it's a 12-inch field mice.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah.
The corn dollies.
Well, I went to Bob Harris's house not long ago for a piece I wrote about record collecting, and Bob lives out in Oxfordshire, where it's very flat.
Yeah.
And they've got a detached house, and they've got a garage, separate garage. And he used to keep his vinyl in the garage. Huge amounts of it. Thousands of things going back, acetates that Mark Bolan had given him. And, a copy of Forever Changes, which John Peel had given him when he sat in his radio show or whatever. And it rained very heavily one night.
Oh, no.
Really rained. And they were aware it was really raining. And Bob just, opened the bedroom curtains, looked out, and there's standing water, outside.
That's heartbreaking.
It just gone into the garage, and he just thought, oh, my God.
I find it difficult to cry about relationships, bereavement, but I hear about records.
No, children are making exceptions for their records.
There's a brilliant bit in Dave's article where he's talking about how a lot of these records ended up with his first wife, and Bob had got divorced. Clearly not very acrimoniously, but he still had visitation rights to his old album. So weekends, he could take his old love albums to a pizza express.
It's an indication of what a softy Bob is, actually, that when he had his divorce from his first wife, that they'd lived together with these records, and she was just attached to them as he was. Yeah. He said, "You can have them."
That's an amazing thing.
Yeah, yeah. And of course,
he's a better human being than any of us. I guess.
You know the story about the Bruno Brooks lawsuit?
How could you do that to somebody?
Can you tell that story, please?
People don't know.
It's an amazing story.
Bruno Brooks was Bob Harris's landlord, right?
Well, sort of.
This is a sitcom waiting to happen.
He borrowed money off Bruno Brooks in order to buy a flat.
Bruno coming around for a rates bill.
Right.
uh, And Bruno Brooks, the market collapsed. You know,
yeah.
Bob lost his job.
Yeah, and he fell on seriously
really
on
hard times. Really hard.
In the meantime, Bruno Brooks was in the process of becoming a multimillionaire through throwing out T-shirts in nightclubs and doing Miss Wet T-shirt competitions. And
which is extraordinary because when I worked briefly at Radio One, Bruno Brooks. This is a bit unkind, but in terms of his intellectual apparatus, was known as Bungalow Brooks because there's
is
nothing
right?
upstairs. No,
but he made his money
That's
out.
Mean,
of,
isn't it?
If you ever go in a petrol station or a branch of Asda and they've got their own
Lloyd's the chemist,
they've got their own radio station. So you'll be in Asda and you'll hear Asda FM and you'll think, who on earth is running this?
Bruno Brooks.
That's who. Yeah, and he's multimillionaire off of it.
But the only way he could get the money back, the only thing that Bob was perceived to have of any value was his record.
Yeah,
and so Bob and his wife were woken up one morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, by a couple of bailiffs.
Awful.
Who were apparently very helpful and said, just ring this number and, you know, you need... And he had to go to court and argue that they were the tools of his trade.
Yeah, this is...
And that was the interesting argument.
At that time, at BBC, I mean, it was contested, in fact, I think, in court, that radio disc jockeys did not need records as the tools of their trade because most of them, no names mentioned, would simply turn up to do their show and open up a box that had been prepared for them by a producer with a sheet of A4 between each one telling them something amusing to say about them. And then they'd piss off back to their country estate.
Of course, that's all gone now.
That's a different world now.
Yeah, it's all computers now. We don't even have a box anymore.
We don't even have a DJ.
Did I tell you...
Richard Skinner's voice in
Well, did I, this, funny you say that. Did I last year tell you my Richard Skinner story?
Oh, no, we're always in the market for that.
Oh, this is... I feel like I'm breaking a cold
pal of ours, by the way, but carry on.
No, not at all. This paints Richard in a good light and a former colleague of mine in a particularly bad light. So I used to be in a double act with a guy called Pete, and Pete is a big music lover. He's very bombastic. He's like that northerner with a chip on his shoulder. He's constantly pissed off and like everything is too much effort for him. Anyway, so Richard was working at the radio station at the time, and we'd got Paul McCartney coming in for an interview. And Richard turns up with a fair amount of rare vinyl. So there's some, I think, like the Butcher cover is in there, and some Wing stuff. And he says to Pete,
with a big felt pen.
Yeah, exactly. He says to Pete, would you mind getting Paul to sign this stuff for me? So Pete's like, no problem. Yeah, just leave it with me. So it's a carry bag full of stuff on the floor of the studio. So we interview Paul McCartney, and he was great as ever. And then Pete does a separate 20-minute interview with Paul for a different program for some documentary he's making or whatever. Anyway, after Paul's gone, I come back in and said, oh, did you get that stuff signed for Richard? At which point Pete goes, oh, shit. And what I would do in that situation, what any right-thinking human being would do in that situation, is say to Richard Skinner, oh, I'm really sorry, we just got carried away and we forgot. Not Pete. Before I can stop him, he's got a black marker pen, and he's not even making any effort to forge Paul McCartney's signature. He's just writing in block capitals.
What he's doing is ruining
Paul
the value.
Exactly.
Double disaster.
Just the worst thing.
That's a good excuse for you to tell your George Harrison. Story.
I went to interview George Harrison, and when he had that record, 88 was it? He had a comeback record. It was 88. And I was the editor of Q magazine, and we got like a world exclusive with George. And I was unbelievably nervous because I'm an enormous Beatles admirer, aren't we all? And I wanted something. It was a good idea to have something to break the ice, you know, these things. And my wife has the Beatles autograph. When she was about, I don't know, 12 or something, she wrote to the Beatles fan club. She was rather sweet. She didn't have a picture or anything, but she just cut one out of New Musical Express. It still had the caption at the bottom.
Times were hard, man.
And she posted it to the Beatles fan club. And unbelievably, back in the post, about 2 weeks later, came her picture with the four Beatles autographs on it. And if you know what the Beatles autographs are, they're quite easy to identify.
Yeah.
Spidery John Lennon, the Ringo Starr's got a little star, the McCartney has a great big Y.
Yeah.
And he went through an awful phase of putting a little happy face in the wild.
Yes.
We'll move on. So I thought it's great. So I took it in to George Harrison. I said, this is fantastic. My wife's got this when she was 12. And he seemed very, very cool about the whole thing. He said, well, it could be the Beatles or it could just be me.
Yeah.
And I said, why is that? This is my hilarious George
Harrison. It's not bad. It's not bad.
Impersonation. He's Welsh. And I said, why? He says, because the boys couldn't be bothered to sign it a lot of the time, so I would do all four of them.
Yeah.
And so he got a piece of paper, and he did all four of the Beatles.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfect. Although I don't think that devalued devalues it because, I mean, they possibly more valuable.
Well, nowadays, you'd take a picture of him doing it, wouldn't you?
A lot were done by Neil Aspinall as well, who could do all four signatures. But
that was a main requirement on your job interview, your application for work for the Beatles. You had to be able to
forge the signatures. I did a similar thing recently. I've got a friend whose mum was mad on the Beatles, but specifically Ringo, who of course doesn't sign anything anymore.
Not anymore.
Because if you send something, it's got to be tossed. It's got to be tossed.
With peace and love, it's going to be tossed. Yeah.
So I was just saying to you before that I interviewed Paul McCartney recently over these reissues of McCartney and McCartney 2. So I took an 8x10 of Ringo and got him to sign it as Ringo. And he did the signature perfectly.
That's so good.
That's brilliant. That's what happens if you spend, years in hotel rooms. You have nothing to do but sign autographs. I got Bob Dylan's autograph many years ago for Mark's wife.
Yeah.
And this is an indication of, if you want yet another indication of how staggeringly awkward and contrary Bob Dylan is, that I handed him the record. And he got a felt pen and put it in his left hand, held it at the top,
not even very far.
End.
He held it like that and wrote Bob Dylan. And he wrote it in double script. Yeah. So it goes. And it took him a long time. Yeah. It says something like, "Best regards to Claire, Bob Dylan." But he's done it in double script, left handed, holding the end of the pen.
And is he left handed? No, he's not left handed at all. You know, deliberately, that's just the way he does
this
it.
This was the agonising occasion where David interviewed Bob Dylan, which is quite a big deal. Very few people have interviewed him, and after 5 minutes Dylan made an excuse to go out and get a glass of water or something, and in fact what he did was go out to talk to the press guy from CBS Records, and the guy said, "How's it going with David Hepburn?" He says, "Oh, it's okay, but he keeps asking me all these questions." that's a doomed interview. Yes,
it was agony.
I hope this hasn't been a doomed interview. This man has to go. He's got to go and work back on the radio, and it's been fantastic to see him.
Thank you for coming along.
The tremendous Jeff Lloyd. Thank you.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
We're rolling, okay. Welcome to another... I want some incidental music, actually. We go, play some incidental music. That jazz
just course. A little background for you now.
Here we go, yeah. So welcome to the Word Lounge on this extraordinarily damp Saturday afternoon at Latitude Festival. The next voice you hear will be that of Kate Mossman.
Hello, everyone.
And on my left, the fantastic John Bramwell of I Am Clute is playing some jazz chords. Please welcome John Bramwell.
Everyone.
He's going to play the guitar later on, and we're going to record for a little bit. It's pouring with rain outside. I don't think you hear that on the podcast, but it's sheeting down. I can just see a sea of umbrellas going across the lake. Typical festival weather. We're having a lovely time. And John, welcome to the podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's very loungy sound.
It is. It's a little bit swing. It's very relaxing.
He's bedding down a mood. That's what he's actually doing.
That's what you told me to play.
I know. I'm very happy with him.
I would have done Motorhead if you had asked.
John, you're playing tonight, I think, in Asia's Lightning and Gasp. But also, let me just say, this is so nice to see. John Bramwell smokes, I didn't think he still made them. Menthol.
Yeah.
Menthol JPS. Yeah. I think it's important to keep a certain amount of delusion in your life. So I smoke these in that belief that these don't do me any harm whatsoever.
I always used to think that it's just a refreshing blast of mint.
Just a bit of mint.
Some of the gaps I've got in mind, I could actually get one in there.
Then you could play the guitar at the same time.
Frank Muir always used to say that the sign of holes in teeth is, could you... Oh, is that a shot?
Amazing.
The big question is, can you eat an apple through a tennis racket? That's the old game. Anyway, no, look, so, John, you're playing at the Words Arena, I think, tonight. What time? We've got
about 25 to 7, and then I think the Bunnymen are on after, and the Foals are on as well. I'm looking forward to it very much.
Supporting the mighty Bunnymen.
Well, this is it. I don't know if I'd say supporting, though.
No. Sorry, not supporting. What am I talking about? Ludicrous suggestion. Do you remember Mac from the old days? Is he still the wonderful old legend he used to be?
Well, I wasn't really around when they were going, but I was a fan as a kid. My sister was a big fan, and I loved them from the start. That whole... It informs a lot of my writing, in a way. Him and Aztec Camera do, and in the way of, like... It doesn't make any sense, and then it does. And we had a run in with him in our first year. We're lucky to go to Fuji Rock Festival, so we're pretty excited. We'd played in the afternoon, and you fly 24 hours, 7-hour drive, and you're pretty much on stage. And after it, we were getting completely leathered. It was very exciting and great. And they turned up, the Bunnymen turned up, and Mac, you know, he's looking quite dazed because he had done 24-hour flight, 7-hour drive, and I'm pissed out of my mind at this point. Got hold of him, was like, call it your mate, the nonsense, but it's not nonsense, fantastic. And he looked, and I got hold of him, shaking him, and it was awful. Afterwards, I was like, what the hell are you doing, John? A few years later, we were playing at Paradiso in Amsterdam, and they were playing the following night, so they were around and about in town. And I was in this bar, and I was going out with this girl who used to go to Bunnymen gigs a lot, to the point that they kind of knew her. Not in a close sense.
No, just friends.
Let's get square that up. Yeah. So we're in this bar, and Will Sargent, the guitarist of the Bunnymen, comes in, recognises Liz. He goes, oh, hi, Liz, yeah, yeah. So I'm stood there thinking, God, I'm the guy who did this to Ian McCulloch back 2 years before, you know, like a crazy fan. And and Liz goes, oh, and this is John. And he's looking at me, oh, yeah, hiya. And then he stops suddenly and stares at me, and he goes, you're that guy who freaked Ian out. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry about that, Will. I'm really sorry. I'm not really like that. Honestly, I'm really sorry. He goes, no, we fucking love that.
I love that Ian's psyche is so fragile.
Two years later.
I know, that's absolutely fantastic. But look, just in terms of your story, am I right in thinking you started out as a busker? Were you a busker in the...
Well, no, it's such a start. I mean, when I was a kid, 9 or 10, my dad lived in Wales. I used to play in pubs, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, like a lot of musicians at some point or other, yeah, I was busking, but not really full on.
I'm fascinated by busking. What songs did you play?
I played some Bunnymen. I was playing Simon and Garfunkel and Bowie and...
Does Bunnymen make as much as The Sound of Silence as for a busker?
Yeah, which was the highest earner?
Well, in Greece, Killing Moon did pretty well.
Really?
Yeah.
So you did it in Greece, and were you in France as well?
In Paris for a while, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not good in Paris.
Really?
Anyone listening thinking of going busking in Paris, don't.
Why not? Really.
I was there one day in some square, and it was about to go well, and at which point I heard this massive kind of drum sound. I turned around, and a whole team of 14, 15-year-old drum majorettes turned up in full uniform busking. So that was the end of that, really.
That's not really busking, is it? I mean, that's cheating. That's a street theatre.
I wasn't really much busking. It was just every now and again, obviously, you know.
Prior to I Am Clued, also, are you
I get the feeling I don't want to talk about busking.
No. And you were a presenter, weren't you? I think on Granada Television.
There was a music show, yeah, on Granada that they had me on, yeah, which ostensibly was a music show. I interviewed Rory Gallagher. I met Rory Gallagher, had a jam with him. It's great. So I did that, and Jason Ribello, the pianist, I met him, was playing with him on the show and interviewed him, and it was going well, but the viewing figures were crap. And
Time of day was it? Was it a morning thing?
No, it was a Friday night, 11 o'clock. Right. And they changed it into something just awful. And that was the end of that.
Did you have to do funny skits and things like that?
I didn't do any funny skits. I think the worst thing that happened was they made a rugby player eat a load of curry and then they put him on a spinning wheel.
No.
It
was like bets on how long he was going to vomit.
You see, do you remember the word you used to have?
I turned my back on television at that point.
Yes, at that point, you've got to have standards, haven't you? But
they threw me out for what they called abusive behaviour.
What was the? Can we ask what the abusive
objections
behaviour was?
To funny skits?
There was a meeting one morning, and they were taking it all very seriously. I was like, how can we sit here? This is shit. It's easy to do. Just do it. Wasn't that abusive, really? But anyway.
But now tell us a bit about the story of the group, because there was a whole team of, you know, Steve Coogan, Henry Normal, and Guy Garvey, and Caroline Ahern. There was a whole team of people who were all working together at that time, or seeing each other and supporting each other's ventures.
I think in the late 80s I was gigging, and I was playing on my own, and I do gigs with be on tour with people like John Cooper Clarke and stuff like that, and it was brilliant, but... The actual music thing was... I mean, I did a support tour with the Lars, and There She Goes had just gone into the top 40, you know, an amazing album, brilliant song. And we played the Boardwalk in Manchester to about 90 people.
Really?
And it's difficult, you know, to imagine now, but That's kind of how bad it was for live music then.
Yeah.
That something as brilliant as that and as popular as that as well really wasn't. People weren't going to gigs. So I was out gigging with a lot of the poets instead. You know, that was kind of my gig. And so, and you gig with the poets, and then it's like, yeah, you'd like Frank Skinner and Steve Coogan as well. They'd be at gigs.
How does the audience vary when you've got comedians and poets as opposed?
Well, it was all right. I mean, we used to like it when it was, you know, as I say, on tour with somebody like Cooper Clarke. I think it's the only kind of genius I've ever met.
Why do you think he's a genius? That's very interesting.
Because words are incredibly easy to John in a way that the sentences are formed in his, not even in his mind, they're in the world before he even thinks of them himself, I think. It's just incredible.
Mm. And Skinner, you supported Skinner?
Well, Frank Skinner used to have a cabaret club. It was a room above a pub in Birmingham. And me and John Cooper Clarke and Henry Normal, people would go and do that gig. So that's how I first ever met Frank. But he was like the compere, yeah. That's how he kind of started. I don't know if he was starting out as really as to be a comedian, Frank, for a while. I don't know.
What was the kind of breakthrough for you? Because I remember reading an article that mentioned the Hold Steady and Wilco and the Doves and Elbow and groups like that worked for a really long time before they got success. I mean, what finally broke I Am Clue? What finally got you into the...
Well, I had a band together with a mate of mine called Brian Glancy, who is the seldom seen kid that Elbow write about in the song Seldom Seen Kid. And Brian kind of died a few years ago, but we're in this band and Brian got into all kinds of bother with drugs and stuff, and so...
Is that why he was seldom seen? What did that mean?
Yeah, well, it may have been. You'll have to ask Guy that one.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But we formed... So me, Pete and Andy just kind of got together in Pete's cellar. In fact, yeah, I had been doing it, writing and performing for a long time, but I Am Clue had only been together about 6 months before we got a contract with Wall of Sound to put our first LP out. In fact, our first LP, we'd been together less than a year when we recorded that. And things actually went very quickly. Went very slowly for 20 years and then very quickly for 6 months, you know. Yeah, so I think
that must
have been fantastic. Well, yeah, it was amazing. I'd stopped writing in a certain way. And the song, I'm going to play a song later that's like, yeah, one of our first single we put out ourselves. And I just somehow came, I stopped writing completely and performing for a while. I just was like, treading water here. And when I came back and we sat down with Andy and Pete, I had a new vein of song, really. There was ghosts in it. I suppose because by then, you know, I'd got a fair few ghosts knocking about.
So you changed, is it lyrically that you changed, or did you change the way that you were writing?
Well, I don't know if I changed it myself. I just seemed to hit a new vein. What I did before was, I suppose, poetic, but this was in a different way.
Mm. And Guy Garvey's a huge supporter, isn't he? What is it that you find so attractive about your music? I noticed he's actually credited as playing Wine Glass and Guacamole.
Yeah, Guacamole is, yeah.
Guacamole, how do you play Guacamole? Well, that's brilliant, isn't it?
We had a sound that we couldn't remember where it come from because we did it all first LP on a cheap 8-track in this church on the Isle of Mull.
Obviously.
Yeah, of course. And there was a lot of overdubs that we couldn't quite erase properly. So on the first LP, which I quite like, is you can hear our original tracks that we've put down that we play with, and then we thought, oh, we don't like that, we'll erase it. But you can still hear the ghosts of all those tracks. On the headphones, you can really hear it.
Brilliant.
And some sounds that are knocking around in there, we're like, well, we'll keep that sound. In fact, we're going to exacerbate that sound. But we couldn't remember what it was that had done it in the first place because it was a distant thing. So, yeah, we just called it Guacamole.
Which,
it's like Guacamole. It was stuff hanging around.
I think we should.
Makes no sense at all. Makes no sense at all. But it did to us.
I think we should go, if you wanted, to the song. Because we've been recording podcasts here for a day, and we're going to do another day of it tomorrow. But this is our first. Our inaugural performance. And just tell us, John, what's the song you're going to play?
Well,
when did you write it?
I wrote it a few years before Clue started. When I was here, I was in Athens busking, and
Brought you back to busking again.
I think I bussed about 12 times in my life. You know,
it's the one
made a meal of it.
Everyone wants to know.
I ended up at Athens Airport with about £8 trying to meet people to lend me a few more quid so that I could maybe get a standby flight. And it was a pretty disastrous trip, and I smuggled myself into a hotel and was, you know, and it sounds, you know, blah-de-blah, but yeah, I was like sleeping in laundry cupboards and things like that.
Wow.
Until I was ousted.
When was this?
That would be, what year is this, right, okay, 1990, about. About 1992. Yeah.
But I mean, that's the rite of passage that you expect of most musicians. You want them to sleep in the laundry, you don't want them to arrive directly out of public school into an enormously extensive contract with EMI Records.
No, it does seem to be happening.
Having said that, chart is awash with this very example. But no, play this song, that's fantastic.
Well, I don't have a capo, so it's going to be an interesting version.
Okay.
It's called Twist. We got reverb, guys? Twisted on destiny, fate and three wishes. We fuck and we fight. Someone else does the dishes. In the meantime, your memory reminisces and twists. Is that blonde blue-eyed boy your leech or your lover? 'Cause one of these days he'll be one or the other. There are one or two things you didn't discover about me. Without the capo there, didn't know where that descent was, but actually it's quite interesting. There's blood on your legs. I love you, there's blood on your legs. I love you, there's blood on your legs. I love you. A most sweet saccharine of love and devotion. Evoke the rich tapestry of all that devotion. Forget all about that and fall in this ocean with me. Twist, snap, I love you. Twist, snap, I love you. And twist, snap, I love you. Ba ba da 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 da. Got it now. There's blood on your leg. Love you, there's blood on your legs. I love you, there's blood on your legs. I love you.
Finally got the right microphone, sorry about that.
Is this a live broadcast? Can we re-record it later when I know the course?
No, that was absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. Well, I am Clute on at the Word Marquee tonight at 9 o'clock, I think it is.
And no, 6:35.
6:35, sorry. And we've got They Might Be Giants. They'll be here in about half an hour's time. So could you please thank very much the great John Bramwell for coming today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Brilliant. The Word Podcast. Two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
Now, this kind of music that you're about to play, you're going to play as a tune, is sometimes described as hokum music.
It is. It's sort of one small portion of like the 30s blues was called hokum music. It was a particular type of sound and thing. It's a real novelty, kind of pretty commercial, early sort of urban blues, I guess, in the 30s. With a kind of usually a bit of a comedy sort of double-edged sort of sexual innuendo lyrics and a kind of jazzy sort of sound.
Right. This guitar, show everybody this guitar. Maybe some people here never seen that kind of guitar. Is that a National Steel?
Yeah, it was a national, yeah.
So that was basically, that goes back to the 1920s and 30s, does it?
Yeah, I guess like the late 20s they must have started making them. They made them for the Hawaiian people, I think, in the beginning. And, you know, in the 20s, if they were playing something in a band, it was usually they played the banjo because it was loud. So, you know, they made the archtop guitars with the F-holes on them, which is not a real sort of full resonant sounding guitar, but it cuts through and mixed quite well. So as always, trying to make the acoustic instruments loud.
They would play for dancing, wouldn't they?
That's right, which and horns and pianos and stuff going. Yeah. So this was another one in that sort of line of trying to be loud. So, yeah.
So you're going to play us a tune. What are you going to play us?
I might play a tune from my record, King Hokum. This is my first record that I made, and I guess much more kind of in the old blues style than maybe my next record that I did. It's a song called Handyman Blues. I sing into this.
Yeah.
I guess you can edit this later.
Yeah, don't worry. We normally polish these podcasts so that they're absolutely perfect.
Shall I play it?
Yep.
Okay, it's called the Handyman Blues. I had a job as a handyman once down the country. It wasn't a proper job where you have to do an interview or have qualifications. I'd actually been on the dole so long that they invented a position for me and installed me in a small little primary school down the country where I was living. I used to spend my time out there with my headphones on, listening to all sorts of blues and things like that, and always a lot of old female singers from the 20s singing songs about handyman. And a few years after I'd done it, I was sitting around the house one night and I come up with this song here. I'll have to impersonate some of my band here because I'm used to having the horns in it. Well, excuse me, ma'am. I want to put my unemployment form, please. Now, hold on a minute, mister. Now, it says here you ain't worked in 3 years. That's right. But don't you think about time you got yourself a job. But I'm looking for a job right now. You're looking for a job, praying that you ain't gonna find one. Can you tell me what the last thing you done was? I used to get up in the morning, pull awake with the rain coming down. That's when I was a handyman, working in a country town. Cut down every tree in the yard. The reason being, I swang my axe so hard. Any man is a good thing to be. Trim the rough edges off your lawn. I trim it so close, old chill runs through your bone. it's your squeaking floor. Hey, handyman, can shine a bell at your front door. Digging mud. My spade had been wrong. She had all over my lawn.
CW Stonking. And next Sunday, a week on Sunday, you're actually taking to the River Thames on the SS Word, on the Word River Cruise, with your Primitive Horn Orchestra, which, have you played a riverboat before?
No, never played on one.
This is a first, but it probably won't be the last. And you're appearing on the, on which stage?
We're down on the Sunrise stage, about 7-something, 7:30 okay. Maybe.
Thank you very much for coming along. Everybody, please say thank you. CW Stonecat.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent every month.